Chapter 18. Gorm spurred his stallion up Hertzwood's main thoroughfare with reckless speed, ignoring the clerks and merchants scrambling to get off the street. It was all the other heroes could do to keep up. "What about the loot?" Haraldin shouted from somewhere behind Gorm.
"Burn the bloody loot!" Gorm shouted back to them. "They'll take it, and your head as well!"
"But the quest..." hollered Laruna.
"The quest was a sham. Why do you think it was so easy for us to find the thugs who stole the stones? We were meant to find them."
Startled bannermen dove from the street as the heroes sped through Hertzwood's north gate. The open road lay ahead of them.
"Why have the quest at all, then?" shouted Caitha.
"We were meant to die in the Mirewood. The mercenaries were there to kill us and pin our deaths on the orcs as a pretense for declaring them foes. The Tar must have foiled their plot, but it don't matter anyway, because we went and gave the Guzvarda tribe the marbles,"
spat Gorm, the words tasting bitter in his mouth.
"Now they're a perceived threat sitting on top of something of great value."
There was an unsettled pause in the conversation as the grim truth settled in.
"King Handor gave us the quest," said Laruna.
"He told us what a bloody headache the orcs were for him. Here's his solution, may he burn to bloody ashes."
"That means Johann the Mighty was in on it," said Caitha.
"Always hated that smarmy bastard," said Gorm.
"I know the feeling," said Jin.
You don't suppose Nil knew?"
"No, Nil ain't the sort for deception. He's the type to fall for—"
Sudden realization struck Gorm, and his heart dropped into his stomach.
"Oh, no."
Nil looked down at the dagger. It was a fine weapon, with a silver grip studded with small gemstones. The pommel was wrought into the shape of a dragon's claw wrapped around a ruby. The blade was hard to see, but Niln was certain it was very sharp, because it was buried to the handle in his chest.
"I don't understand," he said. You were supposed to protect me."
"Indeed we were," said Mr. Flynn, "right until your work was completed."
His work was completed, just as the final words of his scripture had said. Niln had to smile at that, despite himself. He stumbled in the loose gravel of the road, clutching the dagger. His lifeblood ran over his hands.
"And now I'm afraid our time together must end," said Mr. Flynn.
The seven heroes," said Niln.
Perhaps he shouldn't have split the party after all. The thought made him smirk.
"Total nonsense, it seems. But on the bright side, you and your companions can say you were spared all Matra's madness before your deaths."
"Madness?"
The whole world had gone mad, and sanity looked insane. He could see that now. He could see a lot that he had missed, ever-present signs that had nonetheless escaped the notice of a prophet. It was ironic. Funny. Despite himself, Niln started to laugh as he dropped to his knees.
"Or perhaps not," said Flynn.
"Wasn't... nonsense,"
Niln gasped, although he couldn't tell if his difficulty speaking stemmed from the laughter or the blood loss.
"The Almatran prophecy," queried Mr. Flynn. "I'm afraid evidence suggests otherwise."
Niln's laughter twisted his mouth until it hurt. A fog was drifting over his vision, yet he saw more now than he had in all his life, revelations he would never have dreamed of as a scribe. He'd been so wrong about everything, but just not in the ways that mattered. He grinned at his killer, tears of laughter in his eyes.
"Wasn't Almatra,"
he managed, before he pitched forward, and finally, mercifully, fell silent. It was just like Gorm had warned him. Professional heroics is all a laugh, until it isn't anymore. The eyes of Andoran's shrine to Mordo Og flared with crimson light. Ignatius Whithelm, priest of Mordo Og, watched the light with some interest. It wasn't fading fast enough.
"A fighter, eh?" the old man cackled. "Master hates fighters."
The light in the skeletal shrine's eyes grew in intensity and shifted in hue from crimson to purple, and then to a vibrant blue. The air smelled of ozone and ash, and the shrine trembled at a distant roaring sound that was just on the edge of Ignatius' hearing. The mad priest jumped back to escape any sudden blasts, but nothing happened. A moment later, the azure light suddenly winked out.
"Well, that was strange," said Ignatius.
Given that he was living in a pile of crates next to a shrine to the god of death, his accusations of strangeness carried a lot of weight. The shrine's eyes returned to their standard red flicker, and Ignatius carefully settled back down to enjoy the show. The lights had been coming fast and steady all day. A lot of people were dying, somewhere. There is a critical distinction between fear and desperation. Fear is the knowledge that something dreadful might be, the awareness of a horrible possibility. Desperation is the knowledge that something dreadful isn't just possible, but probable, and that escaping misfortune is becoming increasingly unlikely. Gorm felt the difference acutely when he saw the first professional heroes riding toward him on the road to Bloodroot.
"That's a bad omen," said Caitha.
"Heroes don't leave a quest unfinished," agreed Jin.
"Keep moving," said Gorm.
Any faint flicker of hope faded as the day wore on. They passed more and more heroes returning empty-handed, a likely indicator that a job had ended before their team had a shot at it. About midday, they started to see wagons loaded with treasures, sacks and chests of Gilton, cartloads of Vorpal blades packed in branded cases, fine silks and bejeweled beads, pots and pans and armor scraps, and anything and everything of value that one could imagine coming from an orc village. Behind the last of the wagons came a party of four heroes, their weapons and armor still stained blood red. They laughed with each other and talked about loot and career advancement, the way Gorm and his friends had done not 3 days ago. Caitha and the others watched the bloody heroes until they were nothing but a laughing dot on the horizon behind them.
"Gorm, I'm not sure—"
"Right on," he said.
"We know what happened."
"We do."
The certainty was like a lead ball in Gorm's stomach. He squared his jaw and turned back to the road ahead.
"And we'll see it through."
They saw smoke on the horizon, an hour's ride from Bloodroot. They could see the fires smoldering from well outside the gate. Yet the full extent of the desolation didn't dawn on them until they were in Bloodroot's streets, walking among the ruined huts.
"My gods," breathed Laruna.
Ash fell on Bloodroot like a dusting of snow, leaving the city gray and still. Fire had gutted and blackened the huts until they resembled strange outcroppings in a bleak landscape. Fires still burned in the larger buildings, and thick clouds billowed from the windows of the factories. Still, silent forms lay amid the ruins, petrified under the thin layer of ash and soot, like reposing sculptures strewn about the streets. Anything of value had been stripped away. The warriors' weapons and armor, the women's jewelry, even the wargs' pelts had all been torn off and hauled away. Gorm walked aimlessly through the ruined city, his arms hanging at his sides. His mouth was dry and his eyes burning, but the pain was separate from himself somehow, the message coming from someone else's body. The voices of the other heroes sounded distant and muffled, and the images he saw blurred together in one gray, dead miasma. Every sensation was muted and distant, drowned out by the agony roaring in his heart. His eyes fell on a tiny doll sitting forlornly in the middle of what had been Bloodroot's main street. Her skin was burlap dyed olive, her hair an unruly mop of black yarn, and her eyes were cherry-colored beads stitched on with thick twine. She wore a burlap dress and a red twine smile, complete with a tiny pair of wooden fangs jutting up from the corners of her mouth. Some young Orcus had loved that doll, had carried it into the streets, had dropped it in front of the oncoming killers as she fled. How far had she made it? He lifted the doll slowly, tenderly, and tucked it into his belt as he started down the road. He heard the other heroes call after him, asking him what he was looking for. He couldn't bring himself to say. They knew the answer anyway. The chieftain's tower had been looted of every last item, but the marauders had otherwise left it untouched. They found Xerthraka a short way from the tower's base, slumped against a building that was ringed with the corpses of fallen professional heroes. He still wore his geist, the ancestral iron skull mask was caked with blood and ash. Enchanted weapons had cut deep furrows through his flesh, and arrows protruded from him like strange blossoms. Gorm nodded solemnly, apologetically, to the fallen chieftain as he passed. Near the high vault, the shrine of treasures at the center of town, the fallen guards were thickest, having died to protect the treasures within. Their efforts were in vain. The vault was bare, every treasure plundered. The pedestals in the back room, set aside for the burial stones, were empty and smashed.
Lying among their wreckage was the small broken form that Gorm had been searching for and yet dreading to find.
"We honor the dead," he said plainly as he stepped out of the high vault, Tibrin's broken body cradled in his arms.
"I know your heart must ache, my friend," said Heraldin, "but we should not tarry here."
"We burn the orcs on pyres," said Gorm. "That's their way. Every last one you can find, drag them onto some wreckage. The Runa can start the fires."
"Heraldin is right, Gorm," Caitha tried. "Whoever set us up will send—"
"We honor the dead," he said again.
It wasn't a request. It wasn't even an order. It was a fact.
"I'm not sure we should do that," said Jin.
"Who else should? Who else will?" asked Gorm,
laying Tibrin's body next to Xerthraka's. The goblin's knife had been looted, as had any armor he might have worn. All he had was a loincloth and a few stray beads clutched in his hand.
"Can you leave them here to rot after what they did for us? After what we did to them?"
The other heroes looked away.
"No,"
said Caitha.
"Then come on,"
said Gorm, feeling more world-weary than ever before.
"We've much to do."
Laruna set another makeshift pyre alight, wreathing the charred wooden frame and figures stacked within it in a burst of sorcerous flame. She adjusted the silken scarf she wore over her nose and mouth to ward off the soot and stench as she watched the fire burn. When she was satisfied that the fire would eventually burn itself out, she went in search of the next grave. A couple of streets over, Jin and Heraldin were setting up another heap of bodies in the ruins of a hut. It was smaller than many of the pyres she'd cremated earlier in the day.
"Do you think we'll finish soon?"
she asked, a twinge of hope in her voice.
"I believe we're nearing the end," said Jin.
The Noctomancer was the key to finishing the cremations quickly. Laruna remained uneasy about necromancy, but she had to concede that Jin's magic made locating the fallen much easier.
"We should be done by tonight."
Laruna nodded. She'd been sending off the dead since the evening before. She'd mourned for the orcs at first, stealing moments when there was nobody looking to silently weep, but hours and hours of gathering the bodies to the incineration pits, seeing so many people go up in smoke, had leached away her capacity for emotion. Coupled with the exhaustion of a sleepless night, the task left Laruna numb and aching. She wanted to honor the dead, but she wanted to be finished even more. "Have you seen Gorm?" Heraldin asked.
"He's still by the tower,"
Laruna told him. She hadn't seen Gorm come back to camp the night before, and his tent and bedroll were still rolled neatly when she awoke. He'd built the first pyre, the one they laid Xerthraka on, and as far as anyone could tell, the dwarf had been working straight through. A sudden cry came from near the campsite.
"That sounded like Caitha," said Jin.
They rushed to find the elf in the middle of the campsite, or rather the remnants thereof. At first glance, it looked like a bear had rampaged through the small square by Bloodroot's burned-out gatehouse that they'd used as a base of operations, flattening tents and dragging bags out and emptying them all over the ground. Then again, bears weren't so meticulous. Whatever marauder had struck their camp had unpacked their gear and placed the contents of each rucksack and parcel in neat rows. In fact, it was Caitha herself who was making the mess, searching through the rows with frenzied desperation.
"The elixir!"
the ranger gasped as the other heroes approached.
"Someone has stolen the healing potions!"
"What?"
"They're all gone! Even the backup stash! Every one!"
"Do you need one right now?" asked Jin.
"You keep a backup stash?"
said Laruna. Caitha stopped searching long enough to catch her breath, glancing back and forth at the other heroes.
"I don't need one right now," she conceded eventually. "But we're in a dangerous situation here. We don't know who the guild will send after us. And if we're going to be fighting, or even traveling in the wilds for long, a dose of elixir can mean the difference between life and death. We need to find it."
"This is true," said Heraldin. "We won't last long without healing potions."
"Now wait a moment," suggested Jin. "We don't have to rely on elixir for healing. We have a solomancer with us."
The other heroes paused to consider the solomancer for a moment.
"Right," said Heraldin. "We're dead without those potions."
"Sorry," Caitha said to Laruna. "I forget that you have healing magic." "No, I'm with Heraldin on this one," she replied.
The only part of healing Laruna excelled at was cauterizing things. She wasn't sure she could heal a serious wound if her life depended on it, so she preferred that nobody else's did, either.
We need to find those potions.
She turned to search the campsite, and was surprised to find herself staring into Geist's eyes.
Where did you come from?
Geist stared down at her dispassionately.
Is there something you need?
Laruna asked. What's wrong? Asked Heraldin. Is there danger? There's danger. Geist glanced at the bard.
He didn't say—
To the battlements! Shouted Heraldin, already running for the gatehouse.
How can he understand Geist?
Caitha asked as they ran after the unlikely pair. I'm not even sure that he did, said Jin.
Then why are we running after them?
Asked Caitha. Perhaps to find out if he was right, said Jin. When the whole world goes crazy, what can you do but try to keep up? Heraldin, as it turned out, was correct. There was danger. Silver Talon thugs, he said, looking out at a black and silver-clad army. Career thugs had relatively short life expectancies, as their duties often brought them into contact with members of the Heroes Guild. Such matchups invariably favored heroes. Many highly skilled, lethally trained thugs with top-end gear met their ends at the hands of one plucky young hero or another who beat the odds in a narratively expedient blaze of glory. Thugs used an array of tools to compensate: intimidation, subterfuge, appeals to the law, and most crucially, numbers. Veteran heroes had been known to single-handedly eradicate entire platoons of mercenaries. A well-coordinated party could take down several companies of men. Yet no hero can fight forever. Eventually, their magic runs out, their weapons break, their strength fails. With strength of numbers, thugs and mercenaries can take down any hero, eventually. It's not uncommon for an entire battalion of mercenary thugs to mobilize when combat with heroes is inevitable. The Silver Talons brought at least 2 battalions. They marched in neat formations, the sunlight glinting off their weapons as they fanned out around the walls. Laruna could see companies of Silver Talons moving into place along the eastern wall, and more at the west. At the head of the southern force, closest to Bloodroot's gatehouse, a familiar pair stepped forward.
Flynn and Brunt, said Caitha.
Hello, called Mr. Flynn across the distance. I see we've been spotted.
Have you come to see your handiwork? Laruna shouted back.
Actually, I'm here to tie up a few loose ends, Mr. Flynn hollered back. In this business, it pays to be thorough.
Come out. Hands up, rumbled Brunt.
Ha ha, I was just getting to that, Mr. Brunt. You see, by order of the Heroes Guild, I have come to notify you that for your crimes against the freed lands, your heroes' licenses have been revoked. I am authorized to try you as enemies of the city-states and carry out your sentence.
What kind of corrupt institution makes the same man prosecutor, judge, and executioner? Exclaimed Jin.
The efficient kind, shouted Mr. Flynn. I think you'll find that the ruins you inhabit are very effectively surrounded. I'll spare you the empty rhetoric about nobody coming to harm if you surrender peaceably, but I can promise that the harm you come to out here will be much swifter and less painful than what awaits you if we have to scour the city.
The heroes nodded to each other.
Laruna, answer the man, said Caitha.
Her reply was a fiery blast as wide as the road, aimed directly at Mr. Flynn. A pair of Silver Talon mages leaped from the squad behind the Tinderkin and the ogre and erected a hasty shield, but the barrier collapsed under the fiery onslaught. Mr. Flynn and Mr. Brunt barely had time to dive out of the way, and the unfortunate mages behind them didn't even have that.
"I'll spare you the empty rhetoric of promising to let you live if you leave now," shouted Heraldin. "But I can promise that if you and your army disperse, we probably won't kill you today."
"I find it's best not to taunt your foes when you're outnumbered by at least 100-1," hissed Jin.
The bard shrugged. Life is better with bravado.
I was hoping for a cleaner resolution to this situation, yelled Mr. Flynn, dusting himself off as he eyed the black smears on the road that had been a pair of Silver Talon mages until quite recently. But it seems that Mr. Brunt shall have his way after all. He usually does.
Brunt raised a meaty fist above his head and gave a guttural cry. The front ranks began to rush forward as magical shields wove into existence ahead of them. From the back of his company, a line of crossbow bolts whistled into the air.
"This is a poor spot to mount a last stand," Jin observed, blowing a crossbow bolt off course with a wave of his hands.
"I really wish you didn't say it that way," said Heraldin.
"I really wish there was a reason not to," said Jin, ducking another volley of bolts.
"Fall back!" Katha shouted. Laruna loosed a fireball at the oncoming soldiers before running down the burned-out stairs after the other heroes. She glanced out the windows, and through the smoke and ash that still clogged the air, she could see the dark shapes of silver talons pouring into the city. They made for the tower as swiftly and silently as they could, but mercenaries infested the streets, and dispatching them complicated their efforts to go undetected. Thugs gave small screams and gurgles whenever Katha's arrows or Jin's lances of lightning caught them. Silver talons choked on the colorful clouds that burst from Heraldin's smoke bombs and screamed a moment later when Geist's blades found them. Laruna incinerated an entire squad of silver talons with a tower of fire which erupted around them, painting the smoky sky golden.
"Impressive," Heraldin said to Laruna, shielding his eyes from the heat and glare of the flames. "But perhaps we could fight without letting the entire enemy force know where we are?"
"I don't really do stealth," Laruna told him.
Laruna quickly found herself wishing she was a bit better at subtlety. It didn't take long before half a battalion of mercenaries was running at their heels. A burst of sorcerous acid nearly took Geist's head off. A moment later, a crossbow bolt grazed her arm. She grunted in pain and threw a spell back at her pursuers, but her eyes stayed focused on the road ahead. Down a ruined street, through a side alley, and they were on the thoroughfare again. The tower was in sight, but she could hear the rumble of the silver talons charging through the streets behind her. Bolts, arrows, and caustic spells rained down around them, sending up plumes of dust and ash wherever they landed. Geist was already at the base of the tower, hurrying the other heroes up the ladder. Laruna saw something out of the corner of her eye. She gasped as a silver talon leaped from the top of a ruined hut, twin blades flashing in the air. There wasn't enough time to get a spell up, and she instinctively braced for the attack. It never landed. An enchanted arrow slammed into the assassin halfway through his flight, and he finished his final descent with an ungainly roll into a burning hut. Katha waved to her from the window of the tower.
"Thanks," Laruna shouted to the ranger.
"Thank me once you're inside,"
Katha hollered back. Laruna was already in motion, crossbow bolts pelting the ground around her. Another near-miss tore the hem of her robes as she raced up the tower's rickety steps. Behind her, Geist stepped in front of the ladder and squared himself for the oncoming assault.
"No!"
shouted Heraldin, bounding back down the stairs. The bard grabbed the weapons master by the collar and attempted to pull him down to his eye level. Instead, Heraldin pulled himself up to Geist's face, his feet dangling in the air.
"No, my friend, not now! Death is the one wish that you can be certain will be granted some day. If you must seek your end, don't make it today, not when we need your help."
Geist didn't seem to react, until suddenly, silently, he glided up the stairs into the tower, dragging the bard along. A moment later, Jin and Katha pushed the heavy trap door shut behind them.
"Make a barricade," Katha said.
They piled what ruined furniture and heavy detritus they could find before the door, but it was already shaking with the pounding of the silver talons below.
"It won't hold them for long," Jin said.
"What do we do?"
asked Laruna.
"Excuse me," called Mr. Flynn's voice. "I'd like to parley."
Cautiously, they peered out the tower windows. Mr. Flynn stood just below the window, smiling up at them. Brunt loomed behind him, and behind Brunt were silver talons as far as the eye could see.
"Hello," said Mr. Flynn. "I'm sure you're aware by now that the outcome of this charade is really quite certain. But sieges take time, and assaults cost men and arrows, and I'm loath to waste any of the three. So I'm willing to overlook the considerable inconvenience you've caused, to say nothing of the men you've killed, and re-extend my earlier offer. Surrender now, and I'll grant you a swift and mostly painless execution."
Laruna shot a burst of flame at the Tinderkin, but the Silver Talons mages were ready this time, and her spell rippled harmlessly across the surface of a much stronger shield.
"Have your way,"
rumbled Brunt.
"Indeed they shall, Mr. Brunt," said Mr. Flynn.
The pounding on the door resumed.
"Spread out," said Katha. "Look out the windows for some roof we can leap onto, some alley they've left unguarded, anything that can get us out of this situation."
"And if we can't find one?" asked Heraldin.
Then we won't be getting out of this situation,
Caitha said grimly. Laruna checked the back window opposite Mr. Flynn and Mr. Brunt. Directly below the tower, the silver talons were beginning to surround them, all of them watching the windows with drawn crossbows. But beyond the mercenaries, in the clearing where they'd laid Zerthraka to rest, she spotted a forlorn figure, oblivious to chaos around him, stacking stones upon a cairn.
Gorm!
She screamed. Gorm had burned the orcs on great pyres, in accordance with the orcish customs that he could recall. Yet he didn't know any goblin rites or ceremonies, so he buried Tibrin as a dwarf, deep in the earth, with a suitable cairn above the chest. Technically, the cairn should have been decorated with the goblins' weapons and armor, but Tibrin's had all been looted. Instead, Gorm decorated it with the doll from the street, and Zerthraka's ghast, and the handful of beads that his friend had clutched in death. Sweat rolled from his brow, and the smoke and ash and stench of death burned his throat and his lungs. A numbness he had never known before dulled his core, a weariness that bit to his marrow. All of his work, all of his efforts had gained him nothing, and cost his friends everything. No, he'd cost an entire people their lives. He'd always known the system was rigged. He'd have told anyone the system was rigged a few months ago. Yet all they had to do was wave a pardon and some gold in his face, and he'd jumped in feet first. The guild had used him because he'd let them. And now that they'd won, and the Gazvarda tribe was gone, he'd outlived his purpose to anyone. There was nothing left to do but die.
"I knew you'd come," he said.
Mr. Flynn paused.
"Well done, Mr. Ingerson. I must say most people can't hear me approaching when I don't wish to be heard."
"I said you were expected."
Gorm didn't even look at the mercenary. He just stared into the empty eyes of Zerthraka's iron death mask.
"I'd imagined you'd wanted to finish me yourself."
"Well, rank has its privileges," said Mr. Flynn. "As much as I've enjoyed our rivalry these past few weeks, I confess I'll enjoy ending it much more."
"I suppose Niln's dead."
"Officially, he was killed by the orcs during the theft of the elven marbles."
Gorm nodded. He'd already mourned the High Scribe, along with all the rest, back when his heart still ached, before the numbness set in.
"I imagine we were officially killed at the same time."
"That will be the story, once we've rooted your friends out of their tower and I've finished with you. I'm afraid you're much more valuable as victims than heroes," said Mr. Flynn.
The assassin was circling warily, looking for an opening in the defenses that Gorm wouldn't bother to raise.
"Though I must admit you played your part admirably here."
Gorm shut his eyes.
"You knew I'd bring the stones here."
"Sir Johann did, yes." Mr. Flynn beamed, the glee evident in his voice. "He was certain that you'd bring the marbles to the orcs once he heard you were traveling with a goblin. It's why he insisted that you be recruited. And when you punched the elven captain for insulting a greenskin, we all knew that he'd been right."
"He could always count on me to do the right thing," said Gorm, recalling Johann's last words to him. "But why bother with all that if you planned to kill the party in the Mirewood?"
"Heroes have a habit of ruining the best of plans, and your party was no exception. You were our contingency plan, Mr. Ingerson," laughed Mr. Flynn. "We would have preferred that a guild inspector find your bodies alongside some orc corpses in the Mirewood. You escaped our ambush, but then you found the stones and gave them to the orcs of Bloodroot. You slipped out of Hertswood before my forces could apprehend you there, yet you brought your party straight back here. Whenever your team escaped our grasp, you immediately brought them back into our hands. I've never met so predictable a rebel."
Gorm shook his head. He was a rebel no more. The fight had left him. His last failure was his greatest shame. But at least he wouldn't have to suffer it long.
"You've made all of this possible, Mr. Ingerson. I truly mean it when I say that we couldn't have done it without you. And as your thanks, I'll make your end swift."
He could see Mr. Flynn tensing for the final strike, a short sword readied in each hand. Behind him, snickering silver talons watched and waited for their leader to deliver the final blow. In truth, Gorm was waiting for the same thing. He turned back to the cairn he'd built for Tibrin, Zerthraka's ghast, the forgotten doll, the nondescript granite beads. Though, now that he thought of it, the pattern he'd arranged the beads in had broken somehow.
He stared at the pile quizzically. The beads moved. Gorm's breath caught in his throat as the Heartseeker beads rotated in unison to point northeast. Somewhere across the Ruskin landscape, an orc was pressing the Heartstone, calling to his brothers and sisters. There could be hundreds, no, even thousands of them out there, trying to connect again. A spark of something long forgotten awoke in Gorm. They could rebuild the tribe. They could start anew. Yet the orcs would be branded as foes. They'd be hunted by the guild and its heroes. They'd be pariahs, with nobody to stand up for them, no one to fight with them, nobody to take their side. Gorm reached out and seized the spark.
"Me,"
he whispered. Mr. Flynn must have seen the change in Gorm, noticed the sudden glint in the dwarf's eye, and thought better of a frontal assault. The gnome deftly changed course mid-charge, which was the only reason Gorm's sudden punch didn't break his jaw. It was still enough to send him reeling into the dust. "Well," said the assassin, pushing himself to his feet, "it seems that we shall—"
"Shut your trap,"
said Gorm, retrieving his axe and shield. He felt the spark growing, burning, fanning flames within him that he hadn't thought he'd ever feel again.
"You're right. I did this. I was so eager for a bloody title and some thrice-cursed loot that I let myself be blinded to the ways of the world. The blood of the Gazvard tribe is on my hands."
He pointed his orc-crafted axe squarely at the Tinderkin.
"And I'm gonna wash it off with yours."
Mr. Flynn's smirk gleamed like his blades. "I think you'll find otherwise," he said, and he lunged forward again. The assassin moved with a fluid grace, almost gliding through the air as he swept toward his target. His swords seemed to dance in his hands as he moved, weaving hypnotic patterns of steel and death. Gorm held nothing but contempt for such fancy shenanigans. A quick jab from his shield put the prancing gnome off balance, and the following blow from Gorm's axe forced an awkward dodge. Another punch with his shield caught Flynn directly in the face with a satisfying crunch. The reeling gnome stumbled back onto the ground.
"Did you think I was scared of you?"
yelled Gorm, the fire growing within him.
"Did you think I joined the quest because you've got a pair of short swords and you murdered your mum? I played along because I didn't want to pit myself against the full force of the thrice-cursed Heroes Guild and spend the rest of my life fighting their thugs and enforcers."
"They'll still come for you," said Mr. Flynn, trying to scramble to his feet.
"Aye, let them come."
Gorm delivered an overhand chop that would have cloven the assassin's head in two had he not managed a feeble parry. He swept the gnome's sword aside with another shield bash.
"I want to fight. I want them to know my name and to know I'm coming for them."
Mr. Flynn dove to the side and scrambled for his swords. With a guttural roar, Gorm leaped upon the gnome, bringing his axe down with the full force of his rising fury. Flynn tried to roll out of the way, but the axe caught his hand, lopping half of it off, from the edge of his wrist to just above his thumb. The assassin sprang to his feet and tried to run, clutching his mangled hand.
"Mr. Brandt! Some assistance!"
he screamed.
"Burn your bloody guild!"
Gorm roared, charging after the fleeing gnome. The fire within had become a roaring inferno. The rest of the world melted away, leaving only Gorm and his axe and the objects of his vengeance.
"Burn your markets and hang your king! Johann the Mighty is going to taste my axe! You're all on borrowed time!"
"Mr. Brunt!"
screeched Mr. Flynn. Suddenly, Brunt charged onto the battlefield, roaring with a volume to match Gorm's. The dwarf got his shield up in time, but the force of the ogre's punch still lifted him high into the air and sent him flying over the burning rubble. He felt a crack as he hit the wall, and then the world went crimson.